Go to everydaynovelist.com/support to join the madness.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life. Welcome to The Questions, episode 689. So in the annals of rough weeks on the podcast, this has been one of the roughest because we have recorded the next 3 weeks of questions four times. And we've been getting mugged by technical difficulties at every stage. Card corruption, wrong microphones, bad mic placement, strange malfunctions. It's almost as if someone doesn't want us to finish these questions. But we're going to.
And we apologize if by finishing these questions we inadvertently start the apocalypse, because that's how these things happen in the backwoods, at least if you listen to Stephen King.
Yeah, well, yeah. A lot of things are true if you listen to Stephen King. What happens if you inadvertently start the apocalypse? Would you be liable for the damage? Or would you get off because the courts had all shut
down?
Well,
I think you would get off because the only people that inadvertently start the apocalypse are agents of the Vatican, and they've got diplomatic immunity. So
anyway, sorry for all the delays, but hopefully this time it'll work. Please forgive me if the following questions sound a little more polished than usual. I just have answered them several times, so let's hope it works. Here goes. To start off with the real story, we hear from Charles, who says,
"You had an episode not too far back and mentioned plot formula and plot structure. What is the main difference, and what are the pros and cons of each? Is there one better for new writers as opposed to veteran authors? Also, you mentioned that you work in a five-act structure. When searching, I found Shakespeare as an example of this. Can you explain your approach to the five-act, maybe using a film or TV show as a reference to visualize your process?"
Okay, so first of all, I do have to apologize to, I think it was Simon, because after getting this question and reviewing the episode, I realized I didn't actually answer the question Simon asked. Simon was asking about things like the snowflake method. And the snowflake methods aren't actually plot structures or plot formulas exactly. They're more like brainstorming methods. They do result in something akin to a formula, but they're not exactly the same. So I'm going to zip back real quick and answer Simon's question properly, and then zip forward and answer your question, Charles. And Simon, I'm really sorry about that. So basically, snowflake and other things like Bob McKee's story methodology and Save the Cat and other stuff like that, while they all are formulas, they're also plotting methodologies. They're ways of checking, sort of to make sure you've got everything. Ways of creating the situations in your book that lead to the plot. Other stuff like that. They're a kind of creative scaffolding that are designed to help you over the writer's block hump that comes from staring at the blank page. A lot of people who started out as gamers will use their D&D character sheet composition methods to do this kind of thing. And, you know, they will write characters first, because a lot of writers do. But basically what these are is they're, someone has distilled their method down and packaged it in such a way that other people can get access to it. And if you're having trouble finding a method that works for you, cycling through these is a really good idea, because it can get you unstuck. I don't have a personal opinion on what's better or what's worse, because by the time I encountered these, I had already developed my own method. So I will read these things to try to pick up new tricks to see if there's anything I can incorporate into what I do. But I've got a method that's working, and I'm not going to screw with it. And once it stops working, then I'll maybe look at one of these or look at something else. So that's what that is. Now, back to plot and formula. As I was saying in the previous episode, a formula is like a recipe. It's a list of ingredients that goes into a story so that you get a story of a particular sort. Frequently, a formula will have beat sheets, meaning that particular things go in a particular order. Save the cat, as I mentioned before in the last episode and in this episode, is currently the most popular formula, which is why I'm completely sick of it. The first couple times I saw it, it was interesting, and it seemed to work pretty well, even though it felt a little forced. And after that, no, it's so, so stilted, stodgy, and forced, I can't stand it. However, there is quite a lot you can learn from the Save the Cat book if you look at it as reflections on, if you look at it and ask why these things are supposed to work, rather than trying to pull a formula from it. Because like I said, the problem with Save the Cat is that the formula is so specific that there is very little room for actually creating a breathable story. The two best instances of Save the Cat in popular media are Skyfall and The Dark Knight, which came out basically the same year.
Wasn't Dark Knight quite a bit earlier?
No. The summer of that year, and Skyfall was the fall.
I'm thinking of Batman Begins. That's why I'm thinking it was much, much earlier. Never mind.
Skyfall and The Dark Knight are both Save the Cats, and they're both Save the Cats to the letter. And they're both good films, but neither of them wear as well as they seemed like they were going to the first time you saw them. Part of that is because the formula is really effective for drawing you through the story, but if you're writing to that formula, because that formula is so specific, it's not very good at creating material that holds up to a second and third viewing. In both of these films, there are so many plot holes that you can't really even get around them after seeing the films two or three times, which is a real shame because they both have some of the best performances and some of the best moments in their respective film series. But the formula is so straitjackety that it does, it doesn't quite ruin the films, but it does definitely give them a shelf life. So, to step back from Save the Cat, the hero's journey is another formula. The Lester Dent story formula is another formula. The Heinlein juvenile formula, which I wrote Hadrian's Flight to, I spent a couple of years extracting that formula and figuring out what it was that made the Heinlein juveniles work that was different from the other juveniles of the period, most of which have faded into obscurity now. And it turns out there were a couple of things that were special to the Heinlein juvenile formula that made it stand out. So that's where Hadrian's Flight came from, and I enjoyed that formula so much I may write a few more. But one of the lovely things about that formula is that it has a lot of elbow room, and if you're going to be writing to formula, choosing a formula that's got a lot of elbow room or creating elbow room in the formula you choose really, really helps. Heinlein, in turn, derived his from a combination of Horatio Alger, Mark Twain, a German novel type called the Bildungsroman? I can never pronounce that right.
I can't even hope to pronounce German things correctly.
It's the coming-of-age novel, and as well as some of his own innovations, and he synthesized those three formulas together to create his formula. What can get really fun is when you take a formula that was created for one purpose and turn it to another. Gail Carriger did this with Solus. She had written several books before that point, which were quite good, but which didn't have the commercial appeal that the publishers were looking for at the time. So she decided to figure out what she needed to do to write stuff that had more of a commercial appeal. She looked around, she said, well, what's the most commercially successful genre? It's romance. So she read like 200 romance novels and graphed out how a romance book works. Like what page the first kiss is on, what page the first breakup is on, and all that sort of stuff. And she then took that and applied it to steampunk historical fantasy. And the results were fantastic. And that created her first series, The Parasol Protectorate, which is what launched her to international fame. And she, like Heinlein did with the juveniles, she didn't let a good formula stand on its own. She gave it her own spin, and that's why those books stood out the way they did against both the backdrop of romance and the backdrop of steampunk and the backdrop of historical fantasy at the time. Her synthesis was unique, which is what gave it that Carriger-esque quality. But that's a formula. The The thing you want to do with formulas, I think it's seriously useful to learn all the formulas you can and to try writing to them. The more formulas you've got in your back pocket, the more tools in your belt. That's why I'm pecking away at the big book of formulas, which will have, I don't remember how many, but basically the biggest, most influential formulas in the Western literary tradition, all sort of broken down for you so that you can see how they work. Shakespeare's comedies, tragedies, and histories, those all have different formulas. The Heinlein Juvenal formula, the Horatio Alger formula, the hero's journey, the heroine's journey, the Carragher formula, all those sorts of stuff I'll be breaking down in this book when I have a chance to get to it. That's not the big nonfiction book coming out this year. I was hoping it would be, but I've got Deep Characterization is halfway done, and the Autodidact's Bible is halfway done. Anyway, there's a bunch of stuff, and I'm building vehicles and houses this year, so we'll see. Anyway, that's formula. Formula is a recipe. Structure is the skeleton. The structure of a story is just a description of how it's put together, and you can have different structures. Three-act structure is most common in film because it's well-suited to the length and the medium. Five-act structure is most common for novels. Short stories are frequently one, two, or three-act. Plays are frequently five-act, but you can also have two and one-act. Jokes are two-act, most jokes anyway. Feed line and punch line are the two-acts. So, you know, it depends. I've explained this so many times in episodes that went bad that I'm not quite sure what I've covered where. Five-act structure you can see on display most plainly in episodic television, especially from the 80s and 90s, before things went to serial. Since then, the structure has changed a bit to a serial structure, which is usually a three-act with the acts shifted. But in older episodic television, you had four ad breaks, which made for a really easy five-act structure division. You had the cold open, that was your introduction. You had your first segment after the title sequence, that was your rising action. You had the big reversal in the middle after the second ad break, that was your complication. You had the big confrontation and figuring everything out after the third ad break, that was your climax. And then you had your considering everything, reflecting on what's just happened, making sure everybody's okay, and letting go. And that's your denouement. And that was after your final ad break. In the old A-Team episodes, it would go like this. In the first act, the team would get a job and they'd get together. They'd collect Murdoch from the mental ward, steal Face away from whatever con he was running, and all that sort of stuff. In act two, they'd get to the place they were going to help the people they were going to help. They'd get a lay of the land. Then in Act 3, the bad guys would discover that they were involved, stage a big attack that thwarted their plans for how to thwart the bad guys, and they had to regroup. For Act 4, when they would double thwart back the bad guys and destroy the bad guys' plans and drive them out of town, and then in Act 5, Face would have a tearful goodbye with whatever girl he'd happened to be romancing. Murdoch would make silly faces at whoever the quirky character was that they were helping and go back to the mental ward. And Hannibal would love it when a plan came together. And that was your denouement. You can really see the difference in the structures if you look at the Lord of the Rings books versus the Lord of the Rings films. It's one of the reasons that the translation, though beautiful, was not entirely successful, because the Lord of the Rings is definitely a five-act story. And it's a Matryoshka doll of nested five-act stories. And one of the reasons that I prefer five-act, and that five-act is better for novels most of the time, is because of the extra breathing room it gives you. And Lord of the Rings illustrates this really well, because it starts out with the hobbits heading out of Hobbiton and having a series of adventures and picking up people along the way. And then at the end, you get a little bit of a flavor of this in the film, and the film actually got a lot of crap for having too many endings, but it's got nowhere near the number of endings that the book does, because the book ends every storyline in almost reverse order, Aragorn being the one big exception. In reverse order from where they were engaged. As they walk back, you've got Legolas and Gimli peeling off at the peeling off at Isengard to go explore the great forests and the great mines together. And on the journey home, the fellowship gradually disintegrates until when they get into Hobbiton, all that's left are the four hobbits. And then Merry and Pippin break off and they go and have their own careers and lives, and Frodo and Sam stay together as a sort of bonded unit for a while until at the very end there's a reversal, and instead of Sam's storyline ending first, Frodo's ends first. Frodo goes to the Grey Havens and sails off into the west, and Sam comes home and becomes the officiant of the next adventure, and he becomes the Hobbit historian in residence in Hobbiton, and that's the end of the story. You get a flavor of this in the films, but it's nowhere near as extensive as it is in the books, and nowhere near as effective because of that. In the books, it plays very like a symphony. You get the same descending diminish at the end that mirrors the ascending crescendo at the beginning. And so you get a complete cycle, which is what gives the book that mythic resonance it has that the films just didn't pick up. And it's because of a lot of little structural things that they did, decisions that they made in moving the five-act structure of the books to the three-act structure of the films. Another really good place to see a five-act structure is in the television series Babylon 5. And oddly, the five-act structure is much more demarcated because of the way the executives screwed the show over. Because they threatened to cancel it at the end of season 4, and that forced Straczynski to cram all of the climax into season 4 instead of letting it carry over to season 5, leaving an entire surprise season 5 open as entire denouement. Which makes it a little bit awkward pacing-wise in the first half of the fifth season. But nonetheless, season 1 is your introduction, season 2 is your rising action, season 3 is your complication, season 4 is your climax, and what a climax. And season 5 is a denouement, the end of which is so effective that simply hearing the music from it will still reduce, 20-odd years later, will still reduce a lot of fans to tears. So effective. But that's the five-act structure, and when you compress that to a three-act structure, what you're doing is you're blending your introduction and your denouement right into the rising action and the climax. And so you're truncating basically the wings on the story and blending them into the body so you get something a little more streamlined. But novels give you that extra elbow room that you can do a proper introduction and a proper denouement, and taking the time to get to know the characters on the front end and taking the time to say goodbye to the characters on the back end are one of the things that makes a good novel stick in the mind in a way that only the best films do. For a novel to stick in the mind, it doesn't have to be quite as good as a film that sticks in the mind, and the reason is that you've got this extra time to bond the audience with the characters and the world on both ends. So that's why I like five-act structure. And that's why five-act structure is most common for novels. Like I said, the other major structures that you can do are the one-act, the two-act, the three-act, and the five-act, and I think there's a seven-act floating around somewhere, though I haven't studied that one very much. I don't know what else to say about that, but if you have specific questions, do send in follow-ups.
One of the specific parts of the question that I'm not sure you covered is whether any of these structures or formulas are particularly suited to a new writer.
Well, if you've watched a lot of films, the three-act structure is going to feel most natural. In terms of giving you a way to execute the entire story as good as you possibly can, a five-act structure will be better. As far as the formulas go, any of the formulas will help. Anything that you're comfortable working with, or that you're willing to become comfortable working with, that helps you get through the story, is good. And especially as a beginner, because finishing is the second hardest thing after starting. As a beginning writer, your goal should be to get through the story as many times as possible, as quickly as you can. It's not that you want to do a bad job, but what you want to do is accept that you're probably going to do a bad job because you're new. And this is an art form, and all art forms are difficult. But if you get the structure in your head, if you get it laid down in your subconscious, if you know when a story is done. And basically, you connect your ability to write to your sense as an audience of when a story is done and how it works. At that point, you've got all the time in the world to perfect the other parts of your art and your craft. But without story structure, you've got nothing. Like I said, story structure is the skeleton, and without it, your story is a jellyfish. And you, even though jellyfish can be beautiful, they can't stand up to much scrutiny most of the time, especially outside of their native environments. And this, by the way, is what literary fiction is. Literary fiction is the jellyfish of the fiction world. It is all craft and all art and all beauty and frequently very little structure. And so it works really well if you're approaching it as something to be understood on its own terms. It doesn't work really well for quick reading and for active reader engagement and for infinite rereadability unless you have a particular kind of mind. So, anyway.
I want to interject. As I'm listening to you, I'm thinking that a useful shorthand on the difference between structure and formula is that structure is tied to the form of the storytelling, whether it's a novel or a film or a short story or a flash fiction. Structure helps you fit the story to the form, and formula helps you tell a particular kind of story, a genre. It helps you tell a juvenile. It helps you tell a romance.
Yeah, but let's get more specific, because you've made me think of something. Because I was likening formula to a recipe. So let's say you're making brownies. Formula is the recipe. Structure is the pan. It gives your brownies a shape. That's the difference. Thank you very much. I wouldn't have thought of that without you.
Although, if we're going to go with recipes, cake would be a better one than brownies, because brownies don't rise very much, but cake does. And so with cake, it makes a big difference whether you put them in little cupcake things or the three cake pans or a bundt pan. It makes a lot of difference what your cake ends up being. And a brownie is going to be just...
Tomorrow on Cooking with Kitty, we'll find out all about cake pans. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty Nakian, and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer, and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license, and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners.
Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.